Lecture 28. Language Starts Over. Creoles. Part 1.
So pigeons are not real languages. But as far as real languages go, as we've seen, technically there's no such thing as a new language because all languages have been passed down since the dawn of human time. All of today's languages are continuations of earlier ones, which all trace back ultimately to the first language. But there are some examples in the world which are the closest that we know of to new languages. And this happens when people are speaking pidgins, and then for some reason, socio-history has it that they have to speak this pidgin as an everyday language for the rest of their lives. Now, that's hard for us to imagine if we went to Russia and butchered the language. Part of the reason that we never got any further is because that's all we needed. We weren't going to stay in Russia. If you go to Fiji, your Fijian's probably never going to be very good. Berlitz doesn't have a Fijian course, but you don't need to be that good because you're coming home. But that's not the way it has always been for various people on Earth. And so, for example, suppose you were one of the slaves brought from Africa to a plantation, usually in the New World. And suppose this was a situation where, very naturally, you developed a pidgin version of the English or the French or the Dutch or the Spanish or the Portuguese that you were exposed to, but you're not going home. And so you're going to be using that pidgin for the rest of your life, all day, every day. What's interesting is that human beings seem to have not only a universal genetic specification for language, but a universal need to really communicate. If all you've got is a pidgin and you have to use that for the rest of your life, then chances are you are going to expand that into a real language. People have a need to communicate on a real, nuanced level. So if you end up using a pidgin far beyond what the pidgin was intended for, you go beyond summer up in the fjords or disrespecting a man who's chasing you when you're a Native American, then you expand the pidgin into a real language. That real language is called a creole. And so that's what a creole language is. A creole is not only something having to do with Louisiana. We'll get back to that. But a creole is something that comes from a pidgin. So creoles definitely have a relationship to languages that came before. For example, there's some language that provides most of the creole's words, and we'll talk about its grammar. But to an extent, creoles are language born again, or at best, creoles are language stripped way, way, way down and then built back up in directions other than the directions that were followed by that language that provided most of its words. So pidgin to creole is a kind of life cycle. Now, there are actually only a few cases where history allows us to see both the pidgin and the creole. In the vast majority of cases, we have the creole, the pidgin part we have to infer. But there are some cases where we really have the whole history before us, and one of them is in the South Seas. And so, for example, in the late 1700s, the English colonized Australia, and they traded with the Aboriginal people there. And understandably, the Aboriginals at first were not inclined to learn English in anything but a makeshift way. And so there was, big surprise, a pidgin English, a nice pidgin English with a certain amount of rules that grew up for use between the English and the people who lived in this place natively. So a certain way of speaking English arose there, but the English extended their business to Oceania, to the east of Australia, the various islands to the east, and they started using various indigenous people of these islands in various trades. For a while, it was whaling, then it was collecting sandalwood, and then it was collecting sea cucumbers, which were used for soup by various people who thankfully are removed from me in time and place. But all of these things took work, and these things took work that Englishmen were often not willing to do. And so native inhabitants of the islands were taken to do this. There is, roughly speaking, at least one language per island in this region, often many languages on an island. So there was no question of the English learning all of these languages. These men conscripted, often on a much more permanent basis than they had thought they were agreeing to, into these trades, ended up learning a rudimentary kind of English. So all around the region, there was what can be generically called a kind of South Seas pidgin. It had a small vocabulary. It had rudimentary structure. We first start finding evidence of this coalescing in the early 1800s. So one of the early quotes is the following. Kanaka is the name for indigenous inhabitant used by both the indigenous inhabitants in the South Seas pidgin as well as whites. So, no, we all the same are you. Suppose one got money, all got money. You, suppose one got money, lock him up in chest. No good. Kanaka oli sema one. What that means is that the white man tends to have money as a piece of property and to keep it for himself, whereas the Kanaka, the indigenous person, has what we might call a more communitarian approach to money. And what's interesting about this to linguists and anthropologists is that this is an example of South Seas pidgin as early as 1835. Now, this was around, and then there started to be more established sorts of settings. So the English established plantations in Queensland, and this was specifically on the upper eastern coast of Australia. And you have to have people to work on the plantations. And using Africans was going out of fashion at this point, and so they had to get other people. So they took people from New Guinea, which was nearby, and several of these islands in Oceania, and had them work on long-term contracts on these plantations. Now, the workers spoke several different languages, and so the South Seas pidgin became how you communicated in this setting. And so here's a situation where the pidgin is not being used just while you chop up sea cucumbers for somebody or just while you trade some things with somebody over in Australia, then go back to your Aboriginal village. Instead, you're on a plantation using this for years and years. Your language, which nobody's ever heard of except you and the 700 other people who speak it, is of no use. So you have to use the pidgin. That's the way you communicate. So it ends up being used on that basis. And then there was a practice where many of the men, going back to their islands, continued using the language among each other, partly because its use as a lingua franca was useful even back on the island if there was more than one language, and it was seen as a kind of a badge of having been through that experience of working under the English. And so it lived on those islands. When the pidgin was used to this extent, it ended up being expanded. And so people did not stick with the rudimentary structure of things like the early quote that I mentioned. So the pidgin was still around for people who did not use the language much. And so you got sentences like, you plenty lie, which means that you lie a lot. Plenty was a custom in this South Seas pidgin, meaning very or being an intensifier. So you plenty lie. You afraid me satil. You're afraid that I'm going to steal. Me no satil. Me come worship. What for you look me satil? That was just very basic pidgin. That is not a human being communicating in any nuanced fashion. That is a kind of exclamatory and basic accusatory statement. This person has a native language where they can actually speak. But South Seas pidgin in various places became a real language. One of the real languages that it became survives and thrives today. It has the unfortunate name of Tok Pisin. Pisin is business in the phonology, the sound system of this language. And so that's what the pisin means. And talk is talk. And so business talk. And that, of course, would have been one of the uses of Tok Pisin at first as a pidgin, enabling people who speak various languages to trade. But nowadays, it is very much the lingua franca of Papua New Guinea. And it's even used in the government. There is a newspaper in it. Advertisements are in it. And Tok Pisin, although it grew out of this South Seas pidgin, is a language. So, for example, if you want to say, she goes to market in Tok Pisin, then it's emigo long market. Long is a general purpose preposition in Tok Pisin. And so it's not along the market, that's to the market. So emigo long market. She goes to the market. Now, if you want to say she goes to the market regularly, then you have a marker. And so, emi save go long market. And then, if she's going to the market right now, then it's emi go long market istap. And the stop is from stop, and so it's kind of like she stops going to the market, but it means stops within the going, as in it's a prolonged action. So, 애미 go 롱 마켓 이 stop. If it's she has gone to the market, then it's 애미 go 롱 마켓 피니스. Penis is finish. And so what we know of as an F transmutes into a P. That's what penis means. So, 애미 go 롱 마켓 penis. Or she went to market, 애미 빈 go 롱 마켓. She will go to the market, 엠 바이 go 롱 마켓. In other words, this has what we know as grammar. And these are not accidental things. These are very much what you need to describe how to speak Tok Pisin. So, South Seas Pidgin was makeshift. It wasn't something you could be all that good at. It wasn't anything anybody would consider themselves, anybody would consider their language. Tok Pisin is a language. You can speak it well. You can speak it badly. There's even a variety that native speakers of it, which there now are, laugh at, thinking of it as Tok Master, the talk of the master, which is the way whites often speak it, like decently, but clearly not in a way that is really in their veins. So it's very much a language. Example, heavy means heavy in the most literal sense. But there's another meaning of it. It means difficulty. And so you have a heaviness. We don't use heaviness that way. They do. In other words, they're idiomatic uses of words in Tok Pisin. Or if you want to say that you're sad, you say, bel blong mi e heavy. Bel is belly, blong mi is my, so my belly is heavy. That doesn't mean that you need to go on a diet, it doesn't mean that you're pregnant, it means that you are sad because you have a heavy belly, with the belly being considered the center of emotion. So it's a language. It's actually a language. It's an interesting and nuanced language. It started as something that wasn't, which was the South Seas Pidgin, but now it is one. So Tok Pisin is a creole, and it is one of many creoles in the world. Wherever people are forced to take a pidgin or some really non-native level of competence, even if it's not quite as extreme as a pidgin, and make that into a regular language rather than just learning the language that provided the words itself. If that situation arises, then you have a creole. So, what about Louisiana? Louisiana is one of many places where slaves were brought to work plantations, and there was a language spoken which they learned very quickly and not being taught. So there was no blackboard. Nobody gave them French verb conjugations because slaves were brought to the plantation. Generally, the main concern was work, and so you worked slaves. And so they were learning French in these very untutored conditions. They needed to learn it fast. And so they first developed the pidgin French, and then they expanded it into a real language, but not French. It was an expansion of the pidgin into a real language. So in Louisiana, they speak what a linguist would call Louisiana Creole French. And it's a very interesting language in its own right. It's also endangered. Louisiana blacks call that language Creole as if that's the only one. But in fact, there are many languages in the world whose speakers call their language Creole who aren't aware of the one in Louisiana. Creole is a type of language. So, for example, Louisiana is one place where slaves were brought to plantations, but of course there were many others. Where that happened in Jamaica, the language today is called Patois, but actually it's Jamaican Creole English. Where that happened in Haiti, it is called Creole because it is a Creole. Where that happened in Curaçao, then it's called Papiamentu, but actually what that is a Spanish Creole. So, the whole slave trade, in particular, created a whole series of these Creole languages. And in fact, most Creoles were born in plantation settings of various kinds. There was the African setting. There was the history that I just described of Tok Pisin. Tok Pisin is one of a bunch of sisters that are very sister dialects that are very similar to each other. And then there are Creoles in some other places. On the West African coast, there are Creoles based on Portuguese because the Portuguese were the first to come down the West African coast and explore. And when they did that, there were interactions with Africans, and these were predictably in pidgin Portuguese. In some situations, the pidgin expanded into a Creole. So Cape Verdeans speak a Creole Portuguese. Not only is it a different kind of Portuguese, as someone might tell you, but it's one that was born amidst this pigeonizing history followed by being rebuilt into a beautiful new language of its own. And as you go further down the West African coast, you see other Portuguese Creoles like that. There are also Portuguese Creoles, most of them dying, spoken in India and in Indonesia, because the Portuguese, so counterintuitively, given the fact that Portugal is about the size of a parking lot and plays, with all due love for the Portuguese, a very small geopolitical role today, they were actually the kick-butt explorers of a particular time. They actually ruled the world to an extent. The Portuguese, there are only like 7 people in the whole country. And so there are these Creoles based on that now small language in many parts of the world. And then there is a French Creole in Mauritius, which is off of Madagascar, which is itself off the southeastern coast of Africa. And so there are many Creoles in many places. There is a Creole based on Arabic, which is spoken in Uganda and Kenya. And there are Creoles based on various languages, but most of them are based on Western European languages because of the geopolitical things that happened starting in the late 1400s and continuing, in some cases, up until the beginning of the 20th century. So, another wrinkle is that there's a terminological problem. I'm telling you that a pidgin is a rudimentary non-language and that a Creole is something that develops out of a pidgin. But actually, there are many places in the world where what we think of as a Creole scientifically, i.e., it's a full language that can be spoken well or spoken badly and is a vehicle of nuance, is still called pidgin by its speakers for various reasons. So, for example, Hawaii is home to fine Creole English, and yet it's called pidgin by its speakers because of terminology that was in the air over 100 years ago when that language developed. Or a very interesting movement was that there were slaves who were taken, ex-slaves who were taken from Jamaica back across the Atlantic Ocean to the West African coast. And they settled first in Sierra Leone and then moved down that coast. So that today there is a version of West Indian patois, which is spoken not only in Sierra Leone, but in Ghana and in Nigeria and in Cameroon. All of those are essentially variations on the same language. A person from Jamaica can actually have a conversation with someone speaking the same language with variation in Nigeria. However, on the West African coast, that language is often called pidgin. Cameroonians will say they speak pidgin. Nigerians will say they speak pidgin. You can find a Ghanaian who will admit that they speak it, although they definitely do, although they tend not to be aware that it's a whole different language that they should be proud to speak. They will say, oh, well, that's the pidgin. But they're speaking the same Creole that's being spoken in Jamaica and Antigua and all the other islands. So there's that part. So in the world, what is a Creole is often called a pidgin. You know that this quote-unquote pidgin is a Creole if it's a real language. Somebody speaking a pidgin is clearly speaking something halting. That's me making a fool of myself asking for tea. That's pidgin. Creole is real speech. So Creoles are the closest thing we have to brand new languages. And we have to make sure that we understand that there's a difference between Creole and dialect. As with so many things that are sometimes challenging for us to wrap our heads around, it's a continuum phenomenon. So there are some languages that kind of teeter between being a dialect of something and being a completely different language. But there is, in general, a difference. Most of a Creole's words are from the dominant language that its creators learned. And so it can often seem that the Creole is just a version of that language. But actually, Creoles are much more different in their sound structure and in their grammar, to the point that they cannot be considered a type of that language that provided their words. So, for example, in English, you might have a very innocent sentence like, "Where have you been?" That's standard English. Where have you been? Now, a non-standard dialect of English that's probably most familiar to Americans would be Black English, African American Vernacular English, or Ebonics. The way that would go in Black English grammar, perfectly normal and nuanced Black English grammar, is where you've been at. So where have you been, where you've been at. Now, that's different. It's a different kind of rule that creates where you've been at, but it doesn't throw any of us. We don't listen to a person saying where you've been at and wonder what language they're speaking or cherish the fact that we can hear Hebrew on our streets. It's clearly English. But then on the other hand, if you listen to a Guyanese person, Guyana of South America, then the way they'll say where have you been in the English Creole of Guyana is Wisayubinde, which is quite incomprehensible if you just hear it quickly in real time. Now, if I slow it down, it's Wisayubinde. Wisayubinde is which side. Now, you can wrap your head around how that would mean where. Which side you been there. So, Wisayubinde. And the there is a verb, and it means to be at. But I had to explain that. And if you actually heard a person say, Wisayubinde, then you'd have no idea what they were saying. My dissertation advisor was a Guyanese. He spoke perfect standard English. But when he and his wife were talking to each other, and sometimes if they didn't want you to know what they were saying, they would just go into Guyanese Creole. Now, you might possibly consider it a kind of English because almost all of its words are taken from English, but I literally couldn't understand a word they were saying. Part of it was the accent. I suppose if I had become a member of their family, I would have learned to get more. But it was very much a different language. In the English-based Creole of Suriname in South America, next door to Guyana, then it's Peibinde for where have you been. Pe comes from place. That's because in early Suriname, it was Ope. O was short for which. Imagine which. We, wo, wo. Oh, that's what can happen. Then the O drops off and it's pe. Now, that's an intellectual concept. I can explain that to you, but if you're sitting there in Suriname wiping the sweat off of your brow and someone says Peibinde, you can't think about that. And all you know is that where is pe. When you're dealing with an English dialect where is pe, it's time to revise your conception of dialect. This is a new language. So, these are beyond dialect. If we think of dialects as perhaps being kind of like the shells that an electron makes in an atom, Creoles fall outside of that. We're no longer dealing with the atom. They're not attracted to the middle anymore. They're out there flying on their own. So if they're not dialects, then where do they get their grammar? Why are they the way they are? Well, a lot of it is based on the native languages of the people who developed the Creole. So, for example, if you are speaking Suriname, which is this Creole based on English, which is spoken in Suriname, then if you want to say, that hunter bought a house for his friend, then you say, Ahondi mandati ben bai one osu giamati. Slowing it down is, Ahondi mandati, the hunter that, ben bai one osu gi, bought a house give, emmati, his friend. So you buy a house give, not bought a house to give to his friend. Just bang, bang. You just run the verbs together. Now, the reason for that is not just that there's something random about Suriname and that they don't know how to put their verbs together. It's because the people who played the largest part in setting the grammar of this language when they were creating it by learning English and then fashioning the pidgin that resulted into a real language were people where their languages happen to run verbs together that way. There are various hotspots in the world where verbs happen to run that way. One of them is not the West African coast writ large, but a particular part of the West African coast that runs from roughly Ghana through Nigeria, where verbs run together. So one of those languages is called Fongbe, and Fongbe is spoken in Togo and Benin. If you want to say that Koku gave her the crab, i.e. to eat, or something like that, then the way it comes out in Fongbe is Koku take crab the give her. That's the way it happens. So just take crab, give. Koku soa son nae. Koku take crab the give her. So, therefore, the hunter bought house, give friend. So a lot of things in Suriname that are very different grammatically from English turn out to have parallels, very direct, in these particular West African languages. To say hunter that is very peculiar in English. There is no dialect of English, no matter what obscure hamlet you go to in England. Nobody is going to say hunter that. It's always that hunter. You know, that hunter, that hunter. There's no such thing as hunter that. Nobody says that. In Sranang, you say that because that is something, again, that happens in these West African languages. So that is part of it. Often the reason that Creoles are so different is because they're very much filtered through the grammatical sensibility of languages that are quite distinct from English or any Western European language. Then some of it is because Creoles are kind of historical repositories of earlier stages of the language that they got their words from, or dialects of the language that they got their words from that we do not experience much. So, for example, one Creole is in the United States. Of the three that we have here, one of them is Gullah. And Gullah is spoken on the Sea Islands off of South Carolina and a little bit inland, also in parts of Georgia. And Gullah is essentially a variety of West Indian patois. A Gullah speaker can have a conversation with a Jamaican and with a Guyanese. West Indian Creole Englishes tend to all be very similar. But Gullah has some features that are rather peculiar if you look at them. They're not from Africa, but actually they trace to kinds of English that we're unlikely to hear. So if you want to say, I come here every evening in Gullah, then you might say, a blunt come ya every evening. A blunt come ya every evening. Now the is I, and then come ya every evening is come here every evening. What's blunt? We don't have a word blant. And so we wonder, well, why is that? Well, as it happens, there were regional British dialects where you would have an expression belong. And so in Cornwall, you might say, Billy de Belong Gwine Longworthy's sister. I'm making up the accent. I have never heard a Cornwall person, and it's not spoken anymore. But if that was the accent, that is Billy goes with his sister. So Billy de Belong Gwine Long with his sister. So he does belong going. And you can kind of imagine how belong could have that meaning. They would also say, well, he does belong smoking. And that doesn't mean that smoking possesses him, or although probably it does, but it means that he smokes often. Well, there's a short distance between belong and blunt. And so the reason that the Gullah people say that somebody blunt comes here every evening is because that's a reflection of the fact that the slaves who created Gullah, or more properly, the West Indian general Creole that preceded it, they heard regional English speakers. So certainly was not mostly speakers of high standard English who were coming to work alongside slaves in these hot, dirty places. The slaves often were working alongside the indentured servants that we learned about in school, and these tended to be people who spoke non-standard dialects of English. That's what the slaves heard, and so a lot of that kind of speech is in Creoles. There are also many evidences of the speech of Irish speakers, both Irish English and also Irish itself in Creoles, because these were the people who the slaves were working alongside. You didn't spend much time in the big house with the colonial. It was usually with the people who were out doing what you did. Then, finally, there are ways in which Creoles are representative of defaults of language structure. So, for example, we've seen that you can find all different kinds of word order in languages. So we have subject, verb, object. English is kind of vanilla in that. You can have the verb at the end, the verb can come at the front. If you take those three elements, subject, verb, and object, all six possible orders are found in the world, although some are more common than others. However, it's interesting that with Creoles, no matter what the word order is of the word, of the language that provided most of the words, or the languages that the creators speak, the order that comes out is almost always SVO. There's some cases where we found that over the years it became SOV with the verb at the end because a language is spoken alongside that has the verb at the end, and so there's been that kind of pull. But in terms of when the Creole comes out of the oven and is piping hot, SVO is almost always what you have. So there's this reversion to the vanilla order, and that is because many linguists would say that SVO is what underlies all the other orders, that language is basically SVO, and that if it's something else, then that's because something is interfering and pulling the elements out of order. English happens to be a vanilla language in that sense. Creoles almost always are, because it's said that Creoles and starting again are sort of unraveling the gunk and the unnecessary complications and starting again. You can see Creoles as more streamlined in that way. So, that is a basic introduction to what Creole is. If you carry one thing from the lecture, it might be that Creole is not just something that happens in Louisiana. Creolization, as linguists term it, is a general process, about which we will learn more in the next lecture.